Right into it. We're going to do a class on the book of Genesis. Okay?
Yep.
All right. So, where's my clicker? All right. So for those of you who came in late, you know there is baseball in the Bible, right?
Yeah. Write that down.
There you go. For those of you who's listening to the tape, we see a picture of a baseball and a bat in the big inning. Okay, so what's the importance of Genesis? Well, it's the beginning, right? It is the beginning of the Bible. And really, the book of Genesis is intro to God. Genesis sets up every single important story in the entire Bible. Genesis is an incredibly amazing introduction to the Bible. Guess what the perfect final chapter of the Bible is?
Revelation.
Because Book of Revelation is the completion of the book of Genesis. It's incredible. Who would have made it up? It's amazing. So to kind of illustrate that, some of you have already seen what I'm about to show you. All right. This is the outline of the class. We're going to do a little bit about Genesis of worldview. This is going to be our introduction. In fact, we may not even start the book of Genesis in today's class. We might do Genesis chapter 1 and 2. We're not going to get very far. So we're going to talk about Genesis as a means of understanding, as an introduction to the Christian worldview. We'll talk about worldview. Talk about Genesis, creation, and science. That's a lot of stuff that comes up from that, which will be relevant with tomorrow night's class. Although I'm not going to talk about the book of Genesis in tomorrow night's class at all, actually. And then we'll talk about the flood. Then we'll talk about Genesis, prefigures and foreshadows, and Genesis in archaeology. That's the class today. All right, so here is an outline of the Bible, the Reader's Digest Condensed Version. Now, I know that you guys don't even know what a Reader's Digest is. Never mind what a Reader's Digest Condensed Version is. But for people over 60, they know exactly what I'm talking about. But never mind that. So here is the entire Bible in capsule. Genesis 1. God created the earth. He created the universe. All right, well, actually, I've got two versions of this outline, okay? This is one version. Genesis 1, who is God? Genesis 2, who is mankind? Genesis 3 and 4, the problem of sin. Genesis 5 through Revelation, God is solving the problem of sin. Genesis 21 and 22, God solved the problem of sin. That's one way of outlining the entire Bible. Who is God? Who are we? What happened? God solves it, and then it's solved. Okay? That's one way of thinking about it. I realize that's lumping a lot of the Bible in part four of that outline, but okay? But it does kind of show how Genesis and Revelation are really awesome bookends to the Bible. Okay, this is my preferred outline, if you will. Genesis chapter 1, God created the universe, everything in it, the heavens and the earth, and it was good. How good?
Very.
Very good.
Very good.
Very good. Genesis 2, God created human beings so that we could have an intimate relationship with him, and he could have an intimate relationship with us, and we could have an intimate relationship with each other. Genesis chapter 3 and 4, or you could really say Genesis chapter 3 through 11, depending how you want to describe that. We messed up really bad. We blew it completely. And we were removed from the garden. Genesis 5, or Genesis 12, depending on how you describe it, through Revelation 20, God is solving the problem. He's creating a way for us to get back to the garden. And Revelation 21 and 22, we are back in the garden. I'm going to do a series of sermons about the kingdom of God, not for you guys, but here in Merced this summer. And I'm going to say, in that setting, the best illustration of the kingdom of God is the garden. You could use Revelation 21 and 22 to explain heaven, if you will. By the way, when we die, we don't go to heaven. Heaven, because Revelation is, we're here, heaven's here, and what happens? Heaven comes to us. we come together. That's equally, I mean, it's equally true. So we don't go to heaven. We stay here, and heaven comes to us. Not that it's wrong to say we're going to heaven. I'm not trying to make a big deal out of that. But anyway, so God is fixing the problem. So where do we end up? Just look in Revelation 22, and the description is one of a garden. Okay? All right. So I'm going to kind of talk a little bit about Genesis chapter 1 and then do a very, very, very huge sort of side trip here. Okay? Now, I want you to think of the first three chapters of Genesis as primarily theology. Somebody asked me earlier today, is Genesis metaphor or not? And metaphor or what would you say? Metaphor or literal or something like that? The answer is yes. Okay. But whether it's metaphorical or literal is not the main point. You're sort of asking, not that it's wrong to ask that question. The best question is, what is Genesis 1 through 3 telling us about God? That's why Genesis 1 through 3 were written. Now, I personally believe there is historical content in there. There are brothers that I'm close to in our fellowship who believe that it's not historical. Really, not at all historical. And they would have an accommodational view on this. Whatever, I'm not going to get too worried about that. You can ask me questions about that if you want. But let's think about it. Let's think about Genesis 1:1. Let's read it. Oops, my Bible's upside down. I've got to turn it around the right way here. Genesis 1:1. It says this. In the beginning. Let's stop right there. What's that say? There was a beginning. Right there, Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism are disproved, unless, of course, this is not true. In fact, Hindu and Buddhist and Eastern cosmology in general has an eternal universe. Why is that? Because of pantheism. Because in pantheism, God and the universe are coexistent. That is the essence of Hinduism. What is the goal? What's the ultimate thing in Hinduism? Is to be absorbed into the universe, to be absorbed into the thing from which you came. That's, you know, that is what Hinduism is about. And so that's why all Eastern cosmologies are cyclical. Creation, you know, sustaining, and then destruction. That's the trinity of Hinduism, Shiva, Vishnu, Shiva, and Brahma. All right, creator, sustainer, destroyer. And creator, sustainer. There's a problem with that, which is that it's not true. I mean, the universe had a beginning. So either the universe had a beginning or it didn't. But what's the first thing we read in the Bible? In the beginning. So there's some theology there. In the beginning, God. So we learn one thing new, right? First of all, the first thing we learned is there's a beginning. The second thing we learned is in the beginning, God. So now what do we know? Right, that God preexisted the universe. Right, that God exists separate and apart from the universe. Okay, now at this point, dualism, pantheism, panentheism, atheism, in fact, almost every worldview other than biblical theism, I think that at this point, Islamic theism is still in the ballpark so far, because we're only four words into the Bible. And at this point, deism, which is a worldview that's not a common worldview, is kind of big in the 19th century. But basically, almost every worldview is already kind of zeroed out here. So my point is, number one, what the Bible's saying, but also what the writer, of course, ultimately, which is God, the purpose of these first three chapters is theological. In the beginning, good. In other words, there was a beginning. In the beginning, God, right? And then number three, in the beginning, God created. So that tells us about the relationship between God and the universe, right? That the universe is created. By the way, at this point, Mormonism is gone, but who cares about Mormonism? All right, but we'll talk about that. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So there is a physical reality and there is a spirituality. Although you could debate whether that's the point being made by the author. Put it this way. It's possible the author, the one who actually wrote the words, may have thought of the word heavens differently than God has in mind. Because to them, the heavens was the universe outside of the earth. That's their cosmology. But to me, in other words, in the beginning, there was a beginning. God, and then created, and then God created this spiritual reality and the earthly reality. All right, so there you go. All right, and by the way, Hebrews 11:3 talks about this as well. By faith, we know that the universe was created from things that are unseen, that the seen things were created by the unseen things, which is a really great explanation of what we commonly call the Big Bang. All right, great. Another thing about Genesis 1 is that it's a polemic. Now, that's a big, long word. Well, the word's not that long. Does anybody know what a polemic is? Yeah.
It presents a certain viewpoint.
Right. It's a biased argument of one viewpoint against another viewpoint. So when you're doing a debate, you're presenting a polemic argument. But it's a polemic against what? In order to understand what's going on in Genesis 1, you have to know what it's a polemic against. It's not a polemic against atheism, right? It's not a polemic against postmodernism. It's a polemic against the cosmology and the religion of the Sumerian and Babylonian reality of roughly 1800 BC. So if you want to understand the context, it's the context of Genesis 1 is it's a polemic against specifically scholars would argue, and I think it's a reasonable argument, it's a polemic against this document called the Enuma Elish, which was the cosmology of the Sumerian and Akkadian cultures, or the Babylonian, if you will, the creation myth. So basically, there was the accepted creation myth, which I'll talk about a little bit. And then there's the biblical creation myth. And there's things that the Genesis writer says which are really surprising. For example, in Genesis, I don't know which verse, he says, "And God created the lights to govern the day and the night." Well, what do you normally call those things? The sun and the moon and the stars. But the Genesis writer is not even using those words. Because in the ancient context, the sun had religious and godlike implications. So he's purposely relegating them to just being lights. And that is a polemic. So, of course, people want to use Genesis to argue about evolution and the age of the earth. And that is so far out from what the purpose of the writer was. So, again, I'm not saying that Genesis is completely irrelevant to questions about the age of the earth and the nature of you know, the creation of species. And it does talk about how species were created. It gives credit to for the creation of all species to a particular being called God. All right, so it certainly is not a scientific treatise. Think of Genesis 1 as a basic statement about the nature of God as opposed to the Enuma Elish, the Babylonian and Assyrian, Babylonian Sumerian concept of creation. All right, so here's a quote from a commentator on Genesis. It says, "Genesis 1 through 11 is a commentary, often highly critical, on ideas current in the ancient world about the nature and of the supernatural world. In Enuma Elish, God, the creation of mankind was an afterthought." In other words, okay, according to Genesis, where does human beings fit in the whole creation thing? According to Genesis, where do we fit in? I don't mean chronologically. It's not about chronology.
We're like the whole purpose.
Right. We are the purpose. We are the reason. You know, scientists say that they took humans and because, you know, back before Copernicus, we were the center of the universe, right? And then we weren't the center of the universe, but at least we went around the center of the universe. You know, the planets going on the sun, the Copernican revolution. And then in the 20th century, okay, sure, we're a planet going around the sun, and in some random place in a galaxy of which there were tens of, you know, billions of galaxies. And so science made us this tiny thing of the most incredibly mind-boggling insignificance. That's what scientists said they did, you know, to mankind. They didn't do that, anything of the sort. Because according to the Bible, because how is size, what kind of logical argument is that size determines relevance?
Yeah.
Where'd that come from? That's a logical fallacy. Because according to the Bible, we are at the center of the universe, whether we are physically or not. All right, but the Sumerian myth, or the Babylonian myth, is that humans were created as an afterthought. Our purpose and role was to entertain, or literally to feed, the gods. We were created to serve the gods. Okay, that's the view. So if you want to understand what's happening there in Genesis, it's kind of like Acts 17 in a way, but it's a little bit more like take that kind of thing. It's a polemic. Paul wasn't really giving a polemic. Okay, so that's kind of what's going on in Genesis 1. Thoughts or questions? All right, so I want to talk about where, again, I'm going to take a rather long side trip. Yeah.
Might as well ask this. Do we have any idea who wrote it? Who wrote Genesis?
No. Now, the common, you know what the common tradition is, right?
Mm.
Moses. I mean, that's been assumed by Christians for almost 2,000 years. And I've had debates. I've had very, very strongly faithful, very massive believing, and even highly educated, scholarly Christians defend the idea that Moses wrote Genesis. But I think that's utter nonsense.
You think it's nonsense?
Yeah. Now, he clearly had a role in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. But according to, where does the Bible even remotely imply any role of Moses in writing Genesis? Go ahead. No, basically, Moses, he uses Moses to mean the five books. Yeah. Right, which would include Genesis, yeah. But, okay, so, now, there was an editor, there was an editor probably, maybe even after 1000 B.C. There's clear evidence that Genesis was put in its final form fairly late. But Genesis, the source material for Genesis is Mesopotamia, roughly 1,800 BC. I'm going to prove that later on. I'll get to that. But the cultural, historical, language, everything says the person who wrote Genesis was not somebody living in Egypt. That doesn't make any sense. It's coming not from Palestine either, though. It's coming from Mesopotamia, and there's plenty of evidence for that. Now, how much that original material was worked over, and by whom, and when, and where, and all that sort of stuff over several hundred years in which it was oral material, probably not even written down, we could speculate on that all we want. And in the end, I just say, well, it's all inspired by God, and it's really not my job necessarily to explain that. But I would say Genesis probably had multiple authors. Genesis 2 and Genesis 1 almost certainly had different authors, the two different creation accounts. I mean, it's possible they had one author, but good luck defending that in a classroom. I mean, I would think the only reason to defend that is because you have some reason to defend it, you know. So probably multiple authors. Probably created by pulling together a range of oral materials. And probably a final editing job after 1000 BC, almost certainly. There's pretty strong evidence for that. It's entirely possible Genesis ended up in its final form after Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. It's actually somewhat likely. Okay? But the thing is, the source material clearly is Mesopotamia in the time frame when Abraham lived. Okay? I believe Abraham's story is historical. To me, Genesis, Babel, those are prehistory. I'm not saying they're not historical, but they're historical slash prehistory. And so there is significant metaphorical content there. I believe there was an original man and woman, but you know how literally to take. You know, I don't think the original man had the name Adam. I mean, that name is clearly tacked on there for reasons. All right, he could have been named Adam, I guess. I mean, I'm not going to say he wasn't. Who cares what his name was? You know what I'm saying? Just like my sermon on Sunday, Malachi. Malachi means God's messenger, my messenger. So was the guy's name Malachi or not? Who cares? All right, anyway. So you asked a question. It's a long answer to a short question. Okay, good. So I want to talk about worldview because, again, I believe Genesis establishes what I would consider the Christian worldview more effectively than any other book in the Bible. So one's worldview is the perspective one uses to process and interpretation information about the world. In other words, information comes in generally through our senses, and then we interpret that. And our worldview tells us how to interpret. We are not unbiased. If you think you're unbiased, you're crazy, you know. So the best we can do, I think, is to be honest about our biases. I think if we're honest and we admit what our biases are, we're in a position to actually be relatively unbiased. It's when we're not aware of our worldview, when we pretend we have none, which is just crazy. So here's a good question for us. What is the Christian worldview? In other words, how does Christianity present the nature of reality itself? Well, how about Genesis 1 through 3? It kind of is, well, you could think about it. Maybe, don't raise your hand, because come on in, Monica. Hello. We're doing our class on Genesis. So glad you're here. We have a seat. Look at that, your seat just sitting there ready for you. There's ice water in the refrigerator. In fact, if somebody went and got a water bottle, I'd happily take it. Okay, good. My favorite book on worldview, I'm eventually planning on writing one, so this one will no longer be my favorite book on worldview, is by James Sire, The Universe Next Door. It's, you know, it's easy read. It's not shallow. It's easy read. It's great. James Sire, The Universe Next Door. I highly recommend it. It's, you know, 200 pages, 250 pages. It's like reading a C.S. Lewis book, you know. It's not bad. Okay. So these are some of the worldviews. Everybody you know probably fairly precisely fits into one of these worldviews. And again, everybody has a worldview, even if they don't know what their own worldview is. So there's naturalism, atheism. This is a fairly small percentage of Americans. I think it's probably less than 5%. Now, I happen to come across a lot of these people, right? That's kind of, I kind of get thrust in with these people. Okay, postmodernism is not a worldview. Just, you know, I'm listing it here. Postmodernism is the view that there is no correct or proper worldview. So postmodernism is arguably not even a worldview, but if it is one, it's a really confusing one. By the way, I don't have a beef with postmodernism. A lot of Christians from my generation think postmodernism is the worst thing that ever happened, is the enemy of Christianity. To me, the modern worldview is more inimical to Christianity than postmodernism. Y'all are postmoderns. I'm sorry, you are. Even if you don't think you are, trust me, you're a postmodern. I'm a modern because I'm, you know, I was born before 1960. I'm a modern by perspective, and I have nothing against postmodernism per se. Okay, but although it is really confusing because it's the worldview that everybody's right and nobody's wrong, which that's probably not a very good one. But anyway.
Well, what's the difference?
Postmodernism modernism is this idea that truth is gathered through rational analysis and the input of information, and basically our understanding is through empirical and rational analysis getting greater and greater and greater. And but that fell apart because of World War I and World War II and communism and all that sort of stuff. That worldview crashed. Now, in America, people didn't figure that out until about the 60s or so, but philosophers back in the 20s and 30s had already put behind modernism. Modernism is a very optimistic worldview. It really is. It's a very Western-centric worldview. Postmodernism said there is no correct view. In fact, the best thing is to say everybody's right, and it's true for you, it's not true for me. It's relativism, moral relativism, cultural relativism. All right, it sounds like I'm being negative, but there's a lot of things I like about postmodernism. Like in America, we just throw every music together and make this incredible polyglot of really creative stuff. It's great. Culturally, I like postmodernism. Language, food, art. Postmodernism does a much better job on world history than modernism does. But when it comes to ethics and morality, postmodernism is a total disaster. And postmodernism even rejects science as a source of truth, which is, as a scientist, I find that... All right, so...
We're with you, John.
So when old people tell you postmodernism is the total enemy of Christianity, say, all right, dude, whatever, thank you for your wonderful discussion here. All right, but what about your view, your modernist view? The modernist thinks what's important about Christianity is doctrine. Yeah. The postmodernist says what's important about Christianity is the postmodernist loves Luke. In fact, last time we were talking about what's the character of Jesus, trait of Jesus that we like? Was that this morning? Yeah. Was it this morning? Yeah. Yeah. And I noticed, even as it's going around the town, I'm thinking, there's a bunch of postmoderns. Sort of jokingly. Anyway, all right, deism. Deism is the idea that God is real, but God does not interact with creation. In other words, Isaac Newton, the world is a machine, essentially. All right, that was a very, very predominant view amongst intellectuals in Europe in the 18th and early 19th century, which collapsed. In the early, by about 1820, 1830, it collapsed. There are very few deists left. But in science, you find a lot of people who believe in God and are also scientists tend towards deism. Albert Einstein is a deist. All other deists would be, say, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, George Washington are founding fathers of America were not Christian. They were deists. Thomas Paine, the ultimate deist. Okay, anyway. A pantheism, this is Eastern religion. It's also New Age. The idea that God and the universe are somehow coextensive. The universe is God, God is the universe, and you are God, and God is you. And that's really great. I was a pantheist for a couple of years. That was in my initial God journey. I was a pantheist. Animism, polytheism, which is almost all early cultures were either animistic or polytheistic. Okay, dualism, the idea that that reality is a sort of a equal battle between forces of evil and forces of good. Zoroastrianism is dualist. I was joking with somebody having the yin yang on their water bottle. That anyway. and then biblical theism. These are the major. You could add nihilism. You could add existentialism to this list. But this pretty much characterizes, okay. And biblical theism is defined in Genesis 1-3. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
Do you think Paul was a dualist?
No.
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 The flesh and spirit stuff.
No, that's not dualism. Okay. I mean. Dualist says evil and good. I mean, if you want to describe him as a dualist, okay, great, but not this kind. Not this kind. All right, Paul was not yin-yang. I mean, Satan ain't in any kind of equal competition with God, not according to Paul. You're right. I mean, you could say he describes human nature. In fact, actually, in the book of John, John uses dualistic language. John, he used light and darkness. And it, so the Bible uses dualistic language, but no, the biblical view is definitely not dualist, definitely not. There were a number of important dualist religions in the first century. All right? Anyway. All right, so this is my own personal... I wrote this down. This is my... how I would describe the Christian worldview. And a good question is, how would you explain the Christian worldview to somebody who knew nothing about it or knew almost nothing about it? And you wouldn't start by talking about Jesus dying for your sins, because that's not describing the nature of reality. So here's how I would describe the Christian worldview. By the way, this outline is Genesis 1 through 3. Point number one, the physical world is real as opposed to an illusion, which is what Buddhism or Hinduism would say. It's real and it's created out of nothing. And it's good. The nature of creation is it's real, it's created, and it's good. This is the biblical description. Now, what we could ask about that is that true? I'm going to talk about that. Okay, number two. There exists an unseen spiritual reality which is not limited to or defined by physical. In other words, reality has a spiritual side to it and a physical side to it. And neither is more real than the other. Okay? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I'm just sort of going through Genesis 1 here. Number three, the creator of both is God, the God of the Bible. Human beings are both physical and spiritual. We have both a nature of physical and a spiritual nature. So we're Descartes. Descartes was a kind of a dualist. That's a philosophical position. God is characterized by certain qualities. So God is defined by love, justice, holiness, omniscience, omnipotence, omnipresence. So the worldview is a God who created it has these traits. Right, if you ever took a theology course, this is your standard outline of your theology course, those traits that God has. Okay, got it? This is the Christian worldview as I would see it. And again, all of these are absolutely, that's right, this thing doesn't work on the screen. All these things are clearly established in the first three chapters of Genesis. The fact that he is love, that he's just, he's holy, he's omniscient, omnipotent. Okay, great. Number six, in my brief little version of what I would call the worldview, the Christian worldview. Although God's creation is good, evil does exist. Evil is real. This is one of the most difficult questions to answer, is the question of evil. And we could ask, how do the different worldviews, how do the different worldviews handle the question of evil? Well, the nature of evil is explained to us in Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3. All right? Genesis 3 explains the nature of evil. Got it? So there you go. We go, although God's creation is good, in fact very good, evil exists. It's the result of free will and rebellion. Okay? Free will and rebellion is the explanation of evil. So how do we explain a creation which was good and a world in which evil is real? Now, one way to deal with that is to say evil is not real. Okay? And that's pantheism. Another way to deal with that is to say it's evil and good are sort of like, sort of like this. That's dualism. And then there's Christian theism. Okay, got it? And again, the rest of my description of the Christian worldview is because of God's justice and his holiness, those who rebel against him will be judged and separated for eternity. And then number seven, the solution to that is the sacrifice of Jesus. All this is in Genesis 1, 3 through 4, at least in anticipatory form. Okay? Now, I'm going to eventually write a book on worldview. It's may be the next book I'm going to write. All right, it could take a while to put it together. So I would define a good worldview with to have the following three traits. I told you we're going to get pretty far away from Genesis here, okay? we'll get back there. All right. So to me, a good worldview would have to be true. What I mean by true is consistent with reality. What is the definition of truth? Well, you know, that's epistemology, and we could spend a whole thing on epistemology and all that sort of stuff. To me, a thing is true if it's consistent. In other words, everything we know is consistent with that statement. And if there are things we know which are inconsistent with that statement, then that statement is not true. All right, and so I'm going to argue that the Christian worldview is the only one that's true. That's what I'm going to argue. And therefore, Genesis 1 through 3 is this brilliant, amazing, incredible, most amazing essay or whatever about worldview ever written. Number two, it has to successfully answer the questions people actually care about. For example, what is the purpose? Why am I here? If indeed there is any purpose at all. Why is there evil? All right. What is my value? What is the nature of value? What is the nature of ultimate reality? What is the right thing to do? I teach a intro to scientific thought class. I taught it many, many times. And so I can't remember. I might have a slide here. I don't have it here. Okay. That's right. So I talk about science. I talk about science. Science is really good at answering the following questions: where, when, how many, and by what means. Science is awesome at answering these questions: where, how many, how long, when, and by what means. But you know what science can't answer? Why? Worth, value, right, wrong. In other words, every question that anybody actually cares about, science is terrible at answering. But every question that's, you know, maybe it may have a functional purpose, but has no actual ability to fulfill the true human questions, science is pretty good at. All right? So, to me, a good worldview has to be true. It has to provide satisfactory answers to the basic questions that everybody cares about. And number three, it has to make those who believe in it and accept it better than they otherwise would have been. Okay? Now, I'm going to propose that number three is easier to establish than you think. So, all right, what makes somebody good? I think you could put an atheist, a Muslim, a Hindu, a Christian, and whatever in a room and say, all right, you're not going to come out until together you guys come up with a list of qualities of a good person. I think that would be easy.
Yeah.
You know, open-minded, compassionate, all those things. And so we could go back and we could logically ask this question: does atheism make a person like that? Logically. Number two, does postmodernism does deism or pantheism? The answer is going to be no, 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 yes. So here's my definition of a good worldview. It should be true. It should successfully answer the questions that we actually care about. And it should make those who accept this worldview, just logically, common sense says it would make them a good person. And just go to the Greek list of human virtues, and that's it. That's good enough right there. Okay, got it? Now, I'm not going to do a Christian worldview versus other worldviews right now because this is a class on Genesis. So I'm just going to subject this analysis to Genesis. Okay? All right, the hard questions. What about the question of evil? Why is there suffering? Why is there evil? What about the problem of justice, the problem of sin, the problem of death? I believe Christianity answers all these questions so much better than any other view. All right? Why is there evil? Okay? What does Genesis say about why there's evil? No, that defines it. It doesn't say why. Free will. Right? Two trees, right? One tree we kind of like. Which one's which tree do we kind of think that's
tree
awesome?
Life.
Tree of life. What about the other tree?
Tree of knowledge,
good and evil. Why did God put that in there? The answer is because he loves us. You mean he put the knowledge of good and evil because it was hurtful, right? But you can't, love gives a choice.
Yep.
Yeah. In fact, can you make somebody love you?
Nope.
Absolutely not. You cannot. In fact, guys, don't try to make her love you, okay? Bad mistake. Girls, do not try to make him love you, okay? That's the worst thing. In fact, playing hard to get is actually playing hard to get. It sounds counterintuitive, but I'm telling you, it works. Okay, yeah, take notes. Okay? So the Christian answer to this, perhaps the hardest of all questions, why is there evil? At first, sounds illogical. It sounds nonsensical, but it's the only one that actually works. Because you can either say evil is not real, or you can say evil and good are just in this unending battle, or you have Christian theism, which says the reason evil exists is because God gave us a choice. Now, the choice could have been either I give you $100 or I punch you in the nose. Now, that's not a choice. Right? I give you $100, I punch you in the nose. That's not a choice. The choice was either you accept what I have to offer you or you go for this other thing. And the other thing was knowledge that God said wasn't good for them.
Yeah.
And the reason he said it wasn't good for them is because it wasn't good for them. All right, but we know what happened there. We'll get back to that. All right, anyway, Augustine and evil. Evil arrives from the corruption of a nature which is essentially good. What is called evil is good corrupted. If it were not corrupted, it would be wholly good. Remember, this is Augustine trying to explain why there's evil. Basically, he agrees with God in Genesis chapter 1. It says it was good. How good? It was very good.
Mm-hmm.
So how did evil come about? Well, basically, it's a good thing, which because of free will and rebellion was made bad. So is sex bad? No. Is just go down the list. When God said it was very good, the reason is because it was very good. So what happened? Well, how about reading Genesis chapter 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7? It's like, and then, like I said, the rest of the Bible, God's fixing it. Okay, got it? If it were not corrupted, it would be wholly good. But even when it is corrupted, it is good insofar as it remains a natural thing. And bad only insofar it has been corrupted. By who? By human beings. Arguably angels as well, but anyway. All right. Dualism said good and evil are an unending battle. Pantheism says the physical world is evil, or evil is being tied down to the physical. It's missing the God-likeness in you. Naturalism says there is no evil. Postmodernism says evil. Determinism says God is the creator of evil. By the way, this is the Muslim explanation of evil.
God is what?
The creator of good and of evil. Right? And this is Calvinism. This is Calvinism, which is the dominant theology in Christian evangelicalism. Phew, I don't like that one. I said Christian theism, not Calvinistic theism. All right, anyway, so here, Christianity and evil. Evil is real. Indirectly, it's the product of God's love, because God loved us so much, he gave us a choice. We chose evil, and we brought evil into the world. Remember your alternatives, which really don't explain it very well at all. In fact, they leave you like, really? That's their explanation? That it's not real? You're saying, genocide is not evil? You're saying a rape is not evil? Really? That's what the pantheist in principle would say. It's certainly what the atheist would say. Anyway. All right, so Christianity is a good worldview. First of all, it's true. In other words, the universe was indeed created out of nothing. That's a fact established by data. It was good. It's all good. It is all good. Yes, even cockroaches are good. It answers, yeah.
You said established by data. What are you implying?
The redshift, the cosmic background radiation, the elemental distribution. I mean, the only cosmology that even remotely fits the data is Big Bang. And even if you don't accept that, the fact is the second law of thermodynamics says the universe is definitely created. There's no doubt about that. I mean, that's what I'm talking about. Science establishes as close as fact can be fact within science. You could debate that. You could talk about that discussion.
Yeah.
And you could even say I'm using words somewhat uncarefully here.
All right. Obviously, the premise of the Big Bang is what, two atoms collided?
No. No, you obviously don't know the Big Bang. The Big Bang, by the way, the Big Bang was a polemical title. It's like Christian was, you know, it's like the Big Bang. It was created by the opponents of that idea. The Big Bang was, they're like, ha, ha, ha. But the idea of the Big Bang is there was nothing, no time, no energy, no space, even time. And suddenly, even the word suddenly doesn't really have meaning when you're talking about the Big Bang. And then the entire universe came into existence from nothing. In a flash of light. A creation of an almost infinite, unimaginable amount of light, which condensed into matter over time, and eventually into protons, neutrons, electrons, stars, galaxies, all that. Yeah, so the Big Bang theory is that the universe was created by a singularity. An event, in a creation event, which didn't just create all matter and energy and space, but even time itself. If you ask what existed before the universe, the Big Bang theory says that's a nonsense question. If you ask what exists outside the universe, nonsense question again. And so the Big Bang, you just read Hebrews 11:3, it's the same thing. Okay? So, anyway, the Big Bang is definitely not an explosion, that's for sure. It's definitely not a collision either. Anyway.
So then what is scientists attributed to?
Thank you for asking that question. Yeah, what do they attribute it to? Thank you. I'm going to talk about that tomorrow night. And what do they attribute to? Well, a lot of them, God. Others are in a really bad place. See, before the 1930s and 40s, this was the assumption of scientists was the universe was eternal. In other words, scientists agreed with Hinduism, not with Christianity. As a general rule, the scientific community was unanimous that Genesis is wrong and essentially Hindu cosmology is right. Where did they come up with that? From the evidence? No. Because a created universe requires a creator. And by the way, back then, it's not like a lot of scientists didn't believe in God, but God had been sort of kicked out of science, not because of opposition to God, but just because of the nature of science itself. In other words, because of Occam's razor. You know, Occam said the least assumptions you use in producing your explanation is best. And very slowly but surely, from the 1500s to the 1700s, God was kicked out. Supernatural explanation was limited, so you left with the mechanical universe of Isaac Newton, deism. All right, so what you had is scientists, most of them actually believed in God, stopped referring to God as a cause. And the reason they did that is because it worked. It works. But then, once we discover the universe itself was created, scientists are between a rock and a hard place. Yeah. Thank you for asking that question. So now, of course, and then I'll talk about, the finely tuned universe and all that kind of stuff. So finally, they came up with this crazy, ridiculous speculation of the multiverse theory. Which is, talk about ad hoc. We talked about ad hoc earlier. Anyway. So, the Christian worldview, I would claim, is true in that the actual cosmology we know of is only consistent with biblical theism. That's what I would say. If you go back to our worldviews, The only one on that list which fits what we know about the universe is theism, or I think you could defend deism as well. Okay, in fact, you don't require theism until Genesis 3. Genesis 3 introduces theism. So in Genesis 1:1, all the other worldviews are already rejected. The only one left standing is biblical theism and biblical deism. Anyway, and I believe Christianity answers all those questions. Why is there evil? What's my purpose? What's my value? What's the place in the world? What's the right thing to do? All the questions people care about. I'm not going to talk right now about that versus other worldviews, but I believe that the Bible provides the most reasonable, satisfying answers to all those questions by far, and there's no second, there's no close second. Okay? Yeah.
Why do you believe that the answers to the hard questions have to be satisfying?
What I've done here is I've created a definition. Now, if you don't like my definition, not that we're trying to have a debate. See, I stated this. Nobody argued with this. But I stated this, and then I'm arguing based on this premise. This is my personal definition of a good worldview. Now, if somebody has a better definition of a good worldview, step right in. So I am laying this out as a premise. This is the definition of a good worldview. I've never had somebody thought, well, that's a bad definition. But, you know, anyway, if somebody wants to say it's a bad definition, then we can have that discussion. But if this is your definition, if it is, which I'm taking it as such, then I get back to this slide here, and I think Christianity is doing pretty well. Okay? Now, thank you so much. God did not have to be good. You know, I've had people at my website say, you know, I don't believe in God because, you know, because in the Bible God's like this. I said, who said that God has to be, you know, good? Which rule? Who said God had to be loving? Who said that? Who said God had to be just? You know, where did that come from? Well, you know where it came from? Because we're made in God's image and we just know it. You know, that's how we know that's the way God needs to be, because we just know it. We know that's what God has to be because we are created in His image. All right? So, yeah, but a lot of people say, if God is this, then I'm not going to believe in Him. Well, you say, if my boss tells me to do that, then I'm going to quit. Okay, great. You quit. You can quit, but you can't leave this world. I mean, the God that actually exists is the one you got to deal with. You know what I'm saying? So what kind of argument is that? I don't like God. Okay? All right? I don't like gravity. I don't like gravity. So I'm going to step off a cliff because I don't like gravity. Okay. If that's your approach to things, you know, okay. Good luck with that one. All right. So, yeah, that's part of the problem, I think, in our discussions, is people feel like they have a right to tell God what He ought to be like. And Paul said, who are you, O man, to talk back to God? Right, because the Jews were accusing God of not being just. Yeah. If God wants to be unjust, let Him be unjust. I mean, you know, now aren't you glad that the God of the Bible is the actual one and He's actually good? But He's also holy. Some people don't like His holiness and His justice.
Yeah.
I love justice until it comes down on me, and then it's like, I'm not so sure, you know. I like that traffic camera, unless I actually got one of those tickets in. $490, man. I almost stopped. That was so close. All right. Now we're going to go back to Genesis. Although I've been going for an hour, let's take a break of 10 minutes. They'll have another hour session. We will not go till 5:30. We're not going to do that. So we'll do about roughly 2 one-hour sessions. And we've been going 1 hour, so we'll stop. Okay. 10-minute break.
Genesis.
Then we'll actually get into Genesis. And I'll start by taking questions, by the way.